From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. A massive winter storm is churning its way up the East Coast. Snow fell in Florida yesterday. And today, as the storm moves north all the way to Maine, some areas are expecting 18 or more inches of snow, along with high winds, followed by intense cold. Greg Carbon is chief of forecast operations at the National Weather Service. He joins us on the line from Maryland. Greg, welcome.
Good afternoon, Meghna.
Thank you so much for joining us today in the middle of all this exciting weather. Tell us what's happening now. Where's the storm peaking?
So the low-pressure center is located probably about 200 miles, almost due south of Boston right now. Boston is really ground zero for this system at the moment. One of the hazards that you did not mention is coastal flooding, which is now underway in parts of low-lying Boston and along the coast. Some pretty potentially significant coastal flooding. In fact, Boston National Weather Service office just tweeted out a few moments ago, this could be a record high tide for Boston.
Since 1921. I mean, that's not to be laughed at here. Now, okay, so we've got coastal flooding. We've got snow. What about cold? I mean, we're reading, for example, that Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy has more than 100 warming centers open in 34 towns, similar things in other states. Is cold a significant problem?
It is indeed bitterly cold, and the wind is not going to help. It's going to make it even worse. We've been in a cold snap here across the eastern U.S. for about a week, a little over a week. This is just going to exacerbate the situation. Another air mass from the Arctic coming directly across the region late today on the heels of this departing storm. The winds will last for several days, and the temperatures will not get above zero across parts of northern New England through the end of the week.
Now, you know, I mentioned that snow fell in Florida yesterday, and I gave it a little exclamation point there because we're talking about Florida here. But in the south, they're not going to really get a break. Ice and freezing temperatures there as well.
They do have sunshine today, and that can help a little bit. I'm looking at the satellite image here, and you can actually see the stripe of snow and ice that fell basically from North Florida across southeast Georgia up through the Carolinas and into southern Virginia yesterday and last night. And actually, the sun is out, and it will help a little bit on the edges of that snowpack and ice pack, but the air temperatures will remain below freezing, and especially dropping cold at night could cause problems with roads that got some ice and snow last night.
Got it. A couple seconds left here. When's this all going to let up?
It's winter, so we do have a few more days of brutally cold conditions across the eastern United States. It looks like some moderating trend will begin to occur as we move into the weekend, and especially the beginning of next week, expecting temperatures to get up near normal, perhaps still a few degrees below normal. But this will be the last big storm. Now, the Great Lakes have been seeing almost constant snow for weeks on end. So in those areas, they're going to continue to see lake effect snow, basically from Upper Peninsula, Michigan, all the way to western New York. It doesn't end there for a while.
Right. Well, Greg Carbon is chief of forecast operations for the National Weather Service. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, in the southeastern United States, people are thawing out today after the storm dropped rare snow on coastal South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, as we mentioned. But officials expect temperatures to drop below freezing again tonight. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Emily Jones reports from Savannah.
It's unusual to see any snow in coastal Georgia, and it rarely sticks. The 1.2 inches that fell yesterday was the first measurable snow in Savannah in a decade. Savannians with a day off school and work headed outside to enjoy the novelty.
I never thought I'd see the day that I make a snowman in Savannah, but I'm not going to miss this opportunity.
That's Kurt Schwartz. He built a family of snow people near the city's famous Forsyth Park fountain, which was frozen over and coated in icicles. Mary Frances Greenwood also headed to the park with her dog, Bindi, a rescue from Mississippi.
She is a little cold. She's not used to this frigid weather, but she's in a pink little jacket to keep her warm. So I think she's happy.
Coastal residents enjoyed sledding on boogie boards and decked out snowmen in University of Georgia gear. But the icy conditions also mean danger in a region not used to winter weather. Traffic slowed to a crawl on parts of a frozen I-95 during and after the storm, with collisions periodically shutting down lanes. Unplowed local roads froze overnight as temperatures dropped into the teens and 20s. Chatham County Emergency Management Director Dennis Jones says today's sunshine and warmer weather won't help much.
Any snow that melts will eventually turn into black ice during the nighttime hours. So with that, it's going to create some hazardous weather conditions.
Temperatures are set to drop below freezing for the next several nights, so coastal Georgians will likely wake up to frozen streets and icicles on their palm trees for another few days. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Jones in Savannah, Georgia.
Well, today, President Trump commented to reporters on his verbal brawl with former advisor Steve Bannon, saying, "I don't talk to him," and he seems to have changed his tune pretty quickly. Trump was referring to Bannon's complimentary comments about Trump last night on a radio show. This after the president released a scathing statement about Bannon's comments in a forthcoming book, Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House, which reportedly details chaos in the White House, White House associates disparaging President Trump, Bannon calling his son's meeting with Russians treasonous and claiming he, Bannon, was really running the show. Trump sent a cease and desist letter to Steve Bannon and another to Wolf and his publisher. And there's other political news, but when we bring in NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro, we have to ask Domenico, how would you rate this story? I mean, how big is this?
You know, it's a pretty big deal. I mean, considering the fact that you have President Trump and a guy who was his former chief strategist, who was on the same line, had top billing over White House chief of staff, then White House chief of staff Reince Priebus. So, you know, anytime there's this kind of rift and there's this kind of chaos that you see continuing into this new year, that's not good for the Trump agenda, and it's not good for Republicans heading into 2018.
Well, and do you believe what we're hearing? Because the Washington Post, as you know, questions Michael Wolff's credibility, says he sometimes, instead of recreating scenes, creates them whole cloth. But others, we heard from David Folkenflik today saying, we think this is pretty straightforward. And some of the things that we're hearing, for instance, that Bannon thought the meeting was treasonous or that there's going to be investigation of money laundering. I mean, what do you think is politically going to be a bombshell, not just unsettling and gossipy?
Well, you know, Wolf also says he has tapes of some of these interviews, so it'll be interesting to hear who he's got on tape actually making these remarks, because sometimes when things are on tape, it means a whole lot more rather than somebody's paraphrasing or characterization of things. Clearly, this is an explosive book. It's something that's gotten under the president's skin and is not something he wants out there right now.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, there's a lot of other things going on that have been obscured by this, and Washington's also tamped down by this snow. But yesterday, President Trump announced he's disbanding the Voter Fraud Commission that Steve Bannon helped set up. It was established to look for voter fraud. Trump had long claimed without evidence that there was widespread voting fraud. And now he's dissolving the commission that was supposed to look for it.
Yeah, this commission was always something that was sort of looking for something that wasn't there. I mean, they weren't going to find 3 million votes that were fraudulent. It seemed like a vanity project, to be perfectly frank, for the president. But Kris Kobach, who was one of the people in charge of this, is going to take this investigation, he says, within the Department of Homeland Security and is going to continue on with some of this. There was a split among the Democrats and the Republicans on this committee. The Democrats were concerned and upset that they weren't getting the information that they thought they should be getting. They weren't getting all of the information. There were a lot of states that weren't willing to cooperate. We should also remember, when we talk about voting fraud, there was an investigation that was done by the Bush White House back in 2005, 2007, and they found roughly 160 cases or so of potential voter fraud that took place throughout the country. Certainly nothing ever on the scale of the 3 million votes that President Trump lost by in the popular vote in the 2016 election.
Well, and also today, AG Jeff Sessions announced he's rolling back the Obama-era looser guidelines on marijuana. The Justice Department have been instructed not to interfere with states that legalize the drug. On Monday, we saw California legalize recreational marijuana. So what happens there?
This has always been something that a lot of us were curious and wondering, what would Jeff Sessions do as Attorney General? This is somebody who, as a senator, just in late 2016 said, told people during a hearing that good people don't smoke marijuana. So he has a clear ideological view of how this should go. At the same time, the states have flouted federal law. Mm-hmm. So there has always been this distinction, this difference between these two that eventually at some point would have to be figured out. Either Congress would have to pass a law that was legalizing marijuana. People should realize in 2017, for the first time, a majority of Republicans said that they were in favor of legalization right. of marijuana, which is pretty stunning. But that, you know, public opinion is not law. And Congress has not acted at this point. The Supreme Court has not weighed in. So it definitely leaves a very tenuous situation. Back yeah. in the campaign, President Trump said that he was not in favor of going after these states, that he wanted it to leave it to the states. We'll see how he acts.
Yeah. And also today in Virginia, Republican David Yancey gets to keep his seat in the House of Delegates after state officials broke the tie election by drawing, you know, the name out of a bowl. It was his. this means Republicans will maintain a majority in the state legislature. There was a wave of Democratic victories there in November. Disappointment for the Democrats, but still, that was pretty close to have a name out of a hat. Your sense of that in the few seconds we have?
Yeah, definitely. You know, the thing is, the Democrats had a huge wave in Virginia and in a lot of these elections heading into the end of 2017, which bode well for them, they hope, heading into 2018.
Yeah. Domenica Montanaro, lead political editor for NPR. Thank you as always.
You're welcome.
Several European countries are boosting their military capabilities because of the threat Russia poses. But you might be surprised to know that Sweden is one of them. The government has reinstated mandatory military service for the first time since 2010, and Sweden conducted its biggest military exercise in more than two decades last fall. BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera is just back from a trip to Sweden where he spent time with the country's security services, and he joins us from London. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, Sweden is responding to the threat that Russia seems to be posing. But the threat isn't just a military one. I mean, you're actually reporting that the Swedes are also facing a disinformation campaign. Tell us more about that.
That's right. I mean, the term fake news seems to be bandied around a lot these days, but the Swedes are really focused on it. And what's interesting, and what I really learned there, was that they've been focused on it for quite a few years, they say. They've been seeing a growing tide of disinformation, of fake news targeting them. And I spoke to the head of the Swedish security service, Anders Thornberg, and he was quite clear that he saw that threat emanating from Russia. He was quite happy to name the country and to discuss what he saw as that danger. Fake news taking on disinformation, political interference, takes on very different forms, but including things like fake letters, forged letters from government ministers referring to arms deals with Ukraine, which never actually took place, for instance. Also, stories purporting to come from Swedish news websites, but which were actually never from that website at all, to try and mislead opinion. And also the use of automated social media accounts, bots, to push out divisive messages, sometimes those accounts being outside of Sweden. So I think it was interesting to see that this is a country which sees itself really in the crosshairs and as the target for quite a sophisticated disinformation campaign, which has been going on in their eyes for years, but which is particularly of concern to them this year because they've got an election coming up in September. And the concern is clearly that there could be some kind of interference in it.
Interesting. So we're not just talking about social media and bots. We're actually talking about fraudulent documents. Now, in the case of, for example, the United States, where Russian interference was at play, you know, we've been hearing about U.S. security services saying that Russia's goal was to destabilize American democracy or American institutions. Is that what the Swedish security services see as Russia's goal there? And if so, what sort of divisions are they playing on in Sweden?
I think that's right. I think the it's less about, for instance, supporting a particular candidate in the election, and more it appears about fomenting division in the country. And so particularly, for instance, immigration is a very sensitive subject in Sweden. It's a very hot subject politically. And it looks, for instance, as if some of these debates and some of these fake news stories are linked to trying to push kind of anti-immigrant themes and to try and heighten concern over immigration. So it looks like about playing on social divisions and trying to heighten those. Now, the question of why Sweden should be in the crosshairs, I mean, it does appear to be particularly because of the country's relationship with NATO. Now, it's not a member of NATO, but there have certainly been moves in the last few years to get closer to NATO, to do more exercises with NATO. And that is clearly something which the Russians are not happy about. And so the supposition from Swedish experts I talked to at think tanks is that that's the reason why Russia has focused so much on Sweden, because it's close by, just over the Baltic Sea, and because of that relationship with NATO growing closer. And yes, it has been about fomenting division primarily through use of social media and fake stories.
And Gordon, what do Swedes themselves think about the country's more aggressive military posture now?
It's certainly not a unified position on it. And I mean, I did speak to people in Sweden who did feel that that some of the Russia fears were being hyped up, the reason being by people in the Swedish elite who wanted to move the country closer to NATO, and they felt that playing on fears about Russia was a way of justifying a closer relationship with NATO, which some sorts. You can get a sense there that there are divisions within the country about that relationship, and some people who think that the fears are being deliberately overplayed when it comes to Russia. So it's certainly not a united viewpoint, and I think that division is something that we may see played out in the election campaign this year.
Now, you cover security issues more broadly across Europe as a whole. Are these concerns about Russia and NATO in general, are they the biggest security concerns in other European nations?
Well, I think if you look at Sweden, but also other countries as well, terrorism is still pretty much top of the agenda. I think the fall of Raqqa and the collapse, at least in terms of territory, of ISIS, so-called Islamic State, and that concern that all those Europeans, thousands of them, who went out there to fight might be coming back and might be on their way back and might be able to launch an attacks, that certainly is the biggest concern, I think, over Europe. It has been for a few years. It remains very high. The Swedish Security Service were clear that that remains high up their agenda. They had an attack last year, a vehicle attack in April. But I think it's been interesting to see that in Britain, as well as in other countries, this issue of disinformation has been rising up the agenda. 6 months ago, I think people were fairly dismissive of the idea of Russian interference in British politics, and now it's being investigated by a number of committees and people are looking at it quite closely. I think that's something you can see across Europe, certainly more so the closer you get to Russia, but also right across Europe now.
Well, that's the BBC's security correspondent, Gordon Carrera, speaking to us from London. Gordon, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, it's been almost 4 months since Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico and knocked out power to the entire island. Today, almost half of the U.S. territory's residents still have no electricity. Tim Padgett from member station WLRN in Miami says one social media movement is pushing the island's officials to restore power faster.
After Maria, it was 60 days without light.
Back in November, Jamilette Bernier was starting her third month after Hurricane Maria without any electricity. She's a teacher and single mother, and she couldn't afford a generator. Speaking by Skype from Caguas in Puerto Rico's interior, Bernier called those days miserable for her and her two kids. One has asthma and sometimes needs electricity for a respirator.
I was just trying to survive with my flashlight, and everything was hot, and we couldn't sleep. It was very difficult for us.
But here's what added insult to injury. Each night, Bernier looked just across the street and saw a functioning electrical substation with lights on.
This doesn't make sense. Something is wrong.
It didn't seem logical. But Bernier's street was part of a bolsillo, a pocket. Bolsillos are common inside Puerto Rico's decrepit power grid. They're areas the island's Electric Energy Authority, AEE, seems to have forgotten about. Bernier tried to point this out to the power authority, but with no luck. Then one day, while out on the highway getting a smartphone signal, she noticed a Facebook and Twitter page called Adopta un Bolsillo, Adopt a Pocket. It was an internet forum for bolsillo sufferers just like her.
I took a picture and I put it on the page.
Once the picture of her dark street next to the lit substation hit that page, it got results. The next day, someone spray-painted bright arrows on Bernier's street indicating her benighted pocket. A passing AEE crew saw it, and in a few days, Bernier's power was restored. So who spray-painted Bernier's block? The same guy who started Adopta Un Bolsillo.
I like the social media because you can make pressure.
He's a plumber in Caguas named Cheo Santiago, and he's running one of Puerto Rico's most effective social media movements in the wake of Hurricanes Irma and Maria. He spoke with me during a recent visit to relatives in Miami.
This is my hobby. When I got $5, I don't buy a beer, a cigarette, I don't buy nothing. I buy spray paint. And everybody, hey, that's good, that's good. Facebook, I got 18,000 people like the page and follow.
This isn't Santiago's first social media foray. 7 years ago, he started Adopta Un Hoyo, Adopt a Pothole, to call attention to Puerto Rico's awful road conditions. Many Adopta Un Bolsillo followers say it's turned light bulbs back on in their houses and in their heads about how to make the U.S. territory's dysfunctional government more responsive. Jaime Rivera says he thinks it's changing at least the way the electric authority does things. Rivera is a barber in Caguas and a single father of four. A crew restored his pocket's power after AEE officials saw the spray paint from a helicopter. Nadia de Jesus also got help from Adopta Un Bolsillo. Puerto Ricans are tired of this runaround, she said. I wasn't a social media user before, but I am now. De Jesus is a teacher in the eastern city of Rio Grande, where the popularity of Adopta Un Bolsillo helped get the mayor to lean on the AEE. Adopta Un Bolsillo enthusiasts in cities like Rio Grande often spray paint phrases like no hay luz, there's no light. But they say they don't have to do that so much anymore. AEE workers themselves now watch Santiago's page. They're at least aware of it, as Jamilet Bernier found out when she told them she posted her neighborhood's picture on Adopta Un Bolsillo.
They were, oh my God, no, please no.
Puerto Rico's power authority did not respond to requests for comment. But the AEE's new director did say recently that eliminating bolsillos is one of his priorities. Cheo Santiago, who recently got power back in his own pocket, hopes other social media efforts will spring up to push reform at the AEE and at Puerto Rico's equally unpopular power utility company, PREPA.
The government, they watch my pages. I like it if anyone copy my idea.
More social media pressure would probably help. Puerto Rican officials admit now they probably won't have power restored to the whole island until May. For Here and Now, I'm Tim Padgett.
A new numbers out show that U.S. automakers are seeing car sales fall for the first time since the financial crisis. About 17 million vehicles were sold in 2017. That's about 1.8% less than 2016. But industry leaders are optimistic about 2018. Let's check in with Emily Glazer of the Wall Street Journal. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Robin.
And we have heard recently of some strong points in the auto market, strong spending power with a rising stock market. Today, the Dow hit 25,000 points for the first time. So what does the drop in sales mean?
You know, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, Robin. As my colleagues Mike Kolias and Adrian Roberts reported, even though sales fell 1.8% in 2017 since demand declined, the auto sales still topped the 17 million mark for three consecutive years. And buyers did take advantage of low gas prices and low interest rates for good financing deals, though that might not last for too long.
Yeah, but why now? I mean, why are people just not buying? Yes, they're still buying in big numbers, but there's a little bit of a drop. Is it because people are holding on to older cars or?
It's a good question. You know, they're still buying, but there's demand that's fading. And there's also less interest in sedans and compact cars, and that's lower margin.
Yeah. So what impact will this have on production?
You know, it's interesting. Looking forward, especially with rising interest rates and, like we mentioned, less demand and a potential decline in the value of used cars, that could pressure sales. And that means that car makers would likely scale back production even more and ratchet up discounts and rebates, which could be good for buyers. By one measure, we saw that sales are expected to slip to 16.9 million vehicles in 2018.
Well, but are they maybe buying, you know, more SUVs, more trucks, and this is more profitable? Is it made up in some other way?
Exactly. So pickups, SUVs, that's definitely seeing more demand. And that is a trend that delivers higher margins to Detroit and, you know, foreign rivals. But more broadly, when we're looking at what the car executives are saying, they're still optimistic. We've seen them say they're bullish on 2018. Sales should be, quote, healthy. And they're thinking, you know, broadly, that overall employment gains will lead to wage growth. And that, alongside federal tax cuts and the robust stock market, you mentioned the 25,000 hit today, could mean more spending power. And for many, that means new wheels.
Well, that's what a lot of people are crossing fingers for. Look, Emily, we got about a minute before we let you go. There's another market story we want to talk about. It's actually at the market. The Wall Street Journal reporting on rotisserie chickens. We've all been talking about how all these stores now are selling these fully cooked chickens. And apparently, grocery stores using them to draw in customers for other products.
Absolutely. Who hasn't bought a rotisserie chicken for dinner at some point?
Right.
Exactly. You know, it's been big since the 90s with Boston Market when it was rolling those out. And it's, the prices are pretty low. It's in the $5 to $7 range typically. And so grocery store executives are working to cut supply chain costs by cooking chickens more efficiently and throwing fewer of them away unsold so they can keep that price range. It's interesting because they're also adjusting their marketing strategy. So these chickens stand out. And that may literally mean that chicken warmers are in the checkout aisles near where gum and candy traditionally is.
So you have to smell them. Well, people,
exactly.
I just want to say they are marinated in butter, these chickens that they're selling, the rotisserie chickens. And Americans bought 625 million of them last year. Emily Glazer of the Wall Street Journal. We now know what they're trying to do with us. Thank you.
No joke.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Politicians interested in running for president are, yes, already traipsing through the cornfields of Iowa and the snowbanks of New Hampshire, even though Election Day 2020 is 1,033 days away. Nevertheless, there are some interesting names and some interesting trends to note about President Trump's popularity. So let's check in on those two states. Joining us, O.K. Henderson, news director at Radio Iowa. Kay, welcome back.
Good day.
We're also joined by Paul Steinhauser, political director at NH1 in New Hampshire. Hi there, Paul.
Thank you. Great to join you. Thanks.
Okay, so let's talk about the next presidential election. Seems like we just got through the last one. But I want to start in Iowa because President Trump won Iowa just last year, 51-41 against Hillary Clinton. So, Kay, I mean, what's the president's popularity in the state right now?
The Iowa poll, a well-respected poll, has indicated that he is under 50% here. He did hold a campaign-style rally here in June. The entire Iowa GOP hierarchy is fully in the Trump camp. There really aren't any alternate voices in the never-Trump camp among the top Republicans in the state. The only never Trump voices that we hear are people like Ben Sasse from Nebraska, who comes to Iowa to give speeches occasionally.
Okay. So the Iowa Republican establishment then still fully aligned with the president. But you mentioned that poll. So, I mean, do we have a sense as to what Republican voters in Iowa are feeling?
Yes, I think there is some trepidation among Republicans heading into 2018. Iowa Democrats at the local level have been winning in districts at the legislative level where President Obama had double digit and significant victories in the, you know, in the range of 20% and 30%. And Democrats have been winning a few scattered special elections here for open seats in the legislature. So Democrats seem to be energized by these results. Republicans appear to be girding themselves for 2018, hoping to sort of bounce off of what happened at the federal level with tax reform and enact tax cuts at the state level. And so we'll see how that plays with voters.
All right. Well, let's just jump over to New Hampshire then, because, of course, the 2016 election story there was quite different. Hillary Clinton only narrowly won the Granite State by less than a percent over Donald Trump. So, Paul, what's the polling saying about how New Hampshire voters feel about President Trump now?
Yes, the president is well underwater here in just about every public opinion poll that's come out over the last couple of months. The most recent, just over the holidays, was one by American Research Group. maybe not the most accurate, but they had the president at just 27% approval rating. Even among Republicans, it was 60%, which should be a lot higher if you're an incumbent president. So he still has a lot of strong supporters here. Remember, this was the state that gave him his first victory in the New Hampshire primary on his way to winning the nomination and then the White House. But unlike Iowa, the president has not been back here. Not once in the year, almost the year now that he's been in office. He still has a lot of strong core supporters here, but overall, Democrats in this state are energized. They did well in a lot of special state house elections. They did well in our municipal elections in November, and they're kind of pumped right now. And, they're angry at the president, and they're looking forward to voting in 2018 in the midterms.
Okay, so who's been making appearances in New Hampshire and Iowa that might be raising some eyebrows? Kay, let's start with you.
Well, he has not set foot here, but New Jersey's Cory Booker met with delegates to the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, and he has, in previous interactions with Iowans, mentioned that he has an Iowa connection and that he has grandparents who started their lives here in Iowa. What's interesting to me is that you haven't had, you know, Senator Harris, you haven't had Senator Gillibrand come here. You haven't had some of the, you know, the big city mayor, Bill de Blasio was here and he said he wasn't running. But L.A. mayor has, you know, indicated that he's very interested. He has yet to come. So coming to Iowa really puts a flag in the ground, if you will. And there are some folks who've been here that, if I say their names, not many listeners may know who they are. A fellow by the name of John Delaney. He's a Maryland congressman. He's been to Iowa and to see you in New Hampshire, I think, 90 times in the past year.
We actually have a clip of him. He's a Maryland congressman, Democrat. He told the Concord Monitor in New Hampshire that he is going to be visiting New Hampshire a lot.
Across 2018, we're shooting for two times a month to be here on the ground doing what's most important, which is listening to voters and giving them a chance to know who I am, how I've lived my life, what I've done with my life, where I come from, and how I think about things.
So, Paul, talk to us about the early ground game going on in New Hampshire.
It is well underway here. That was my interview with Delaney back in November. And yeah, you know, he's actually declared he's running for president, unlike everybody else who says, well, maybe not. Not well known at all. And that's probably why he needs to come up here every other week just about and to Iowa as well, because he's barely known outside of his district. We've had Jason Kander, the former Missouri Secretary of State, another person most people will never have heard of. He's the founder of Let America Vote, a pro-voting rights group. He's been here six times. He's coming back. A couple of names people will remember. Former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley. He ran in 2016. He's already made three trips to New Hampshire over the past year.
Wow.
Bernie Sanders. He's been here twice already. Not you know, listen, if you're in Vermont, it's pretty easy to come to New Hampshire. And Vice President Joe Biden has been here as well. And you were talking about Mayor Garcetti. He did make the long flight from L.A. here to New Hampshire. We've had one Republican here, John Kasich. He came here last April on his book tour. He's probably going to come back later this winter or early in the spring.
Kay, has the Ohio governor, John Kasich, has he been to Iowa recently?
He has not been to Iowa recently, but a fellow named James Lankford, who's an Oklahoma senator, gave a widely acclaimed speech to a group of 600 conservatives here. Tom Cotton has been here. Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina has been here. And Iowa's own Joni Ernst went down to South Carolina and gave a speech at a big event down there. So you do have some activity, sort of underground activity, if you will, on the Republican side. From Ohio, though, we saw Congressman Tim Ryan. And there's another reason that people come to New Hampshire and they come to Iowa. It's because they have other ambitions in Washington, D.C. Tim Ryan had challenged Nancy Pelosi for a leadership of House Democrats.
Right.
Sometimes people run for president not to run for president.
That makes me think of another Democratic congressman who's recently visited Iowa, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, who actually supported Ryan over Nancy Pelosi for Democratic leadership in the House. He was in Iowa last September. We got a little tape here about what he had to say about his own party.
We've got to get back in touch with those voters that we have lost. Because the reality is that a lot of Americans feel left behind, not just by the Republicans, but by our party and by our country.
Kay, you very kindly gave us that tape. So what do you make of Seth Moulton in Iowa?
I think he hopes that his resume may resonate with people. He seemed to try to be emulating sort of the Barack Obama fresh face, new way for the party forward mantra for folks. But you know, he's going to be crowded out, especially if I think this idea of the, you know, Harvey Weinstein year of 2017 sort of continues. You're going to see people clamoring for some of the women in this field to sort of make their case that it's time to, again, nominate a woman for president.
Huh. And your thoughts on that, Paul?
Yeah, no, I think Kay makes a great point. We haven't seen Kirsten Gillibrand, who's been getting a lot of buzz. We haven't seen Elizabeth Warren even come over the border from Massachusetts to come up here yet.
Well, and the other thing you can't calculate is somebody vaulting into a position of national prominence because of some story we don't yet know about. And at this point, I'm thinking of somebody like a Virginia Senator Mark Warner. He is in a position of leadership on the Senate Intelligence Committee. If they become a central player in some sort of Mueller play that, you know, draws out through 2018, he could vault into the mind's eye of a lot of people as a potential presidential contender. And I think Iowans and the residents of New Hampshire will do what they always do, winnow the field.
Kay Henderson, news director at Radio Iowa, it's always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the invitation.
And Paul Steinhauser, political director at NH1 in New Hampshire, great to have you as well.
Thanks, Magda.
In a letter to the UN, Iran has accused the U.S. of grotesque interference in its domestic politics through numerous absurd tweets that incited Iranians to engage in disruptive acts. Well, President Trump has been tweeting in support of the protesters in Iran, criticizing the Obama response to the 2009 uprising and the U.S.-led nuclear deal. And a voice you might not expect to agree, at least about the 2009 protest, belongs to Ambassador Dennis Ross, former special assistant to President Obama who helped craft his Iran policy. Ambassador Ross, welcome.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
And explain those comments about President Trump's tweets. This was earlier in the week on Monday when you spoke. You had said at the time, and reflecting about the Obama administration reaction to the 2009 uprising, that you'd heard in the administration from the protesters who asked the U.S. to kind of keep a muted tone because they didn't want the Iranian leadership to portray the protests as being, you know, outside interests. Why was that a mistake? Because now we see the Iranian leadership accusing President Trump of causing the protests.
Whether we say something or we don't say something, the Iranians are going to accuse us. They're going to try to shift the focus away from themselves. They're going to try to suggest that whatever is happening there is a function of foreign instigation. And the fact is, when you had 2 to 3 million people out in the street in Tehran protesting an election that they saw as being stolen, our posture, I think, should have been more open. It should have been clear that those protests had to be respected, if for no other reason than to create a kind of standard that the rest of the world would embrace as well, and to raise the cost to the Iranians of any kind of crackdown. And when I say this, I'm saying it in retrospect, because at the time, I was part of the decision making. I took these messages we were getting quite seriously. To be fair, we were getting messages, other messages from the Green Movement outside of Iran, saying we needed to be much more vocal. Mm. We tilted towards the inside, and that's why I say in retrospect, I think it probably wasn't the right thing to do. I think the balance that needs to be struck is making it clear we're focused on what the Iranian regime is doing. We're focused on certain standards of behavior that should be met. We shouldn't look like we're cheerleaders.
Well, that gets touchy because people are wondering, what did you mean? Did you mean some kind of military assistance? Did you mean, you know, some kind of more physical backing? You're saying, to be clear, that you wish the U.S. had been vocal about what the criticisms of the Iranian government were. That's what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying. What happened in Iran in 2009 and what's happening there today, where you've had over 40 cities where protests and unrest have taken place, that's homegrown. Today, there may well have been expectations that were raised that the economy would improve, and it hasn't. And it hasn't in a context where it's clear that half the economy is basically, you know, wedded to religious trusts or the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard, then there's a high level of corruption. And what you're seeing is a level of frustration about, I would say, expectations that on the one hand haven't been met, but also frustration what they see, lots of Iranian money being spent on adventures on the outside and, in a sense, not addressing their needs.
You write a terrific piece about that this week, that, in fact, it's only in part about the disappointment of the economy that would follow the deal that was made with Iran and the lifting of sanctions. You say it's about Iran's adventures in the Middle East, spending so much money in other places, and some of the chants, in fact, on the street that we wouldn't know what they were. But you write one of the earliest chants was, "Not Gaza, not Lebanon, my life for Iran." In other words, they're protesting Iran's supporting of the Palestinians, supporting of Hezbollah in Lebanon, supporting of Assad in Syria. That's what they're angry about.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, there are other signs that were focused much more exclusively on Syria. There are estimates that if you look at the last few years, the Iranians have committed as much as $15 billion to Syria. So the cost is high. It's not the first time there have been some voices complaining about the cost of adventurism on the outside. It's the first time, though, that these protests have come, A, not from the urban elites, B, coming from the countryside, which has always been the backbone of the regime. And I think that's one of the things that has probably caused the regime the greatest discomfort.
Well, we just want to be clear, though, because President Trump, while criticizing the Obama administration for its response to the 2009 uprising, you agree with some of that criticism, is also criticizing the nuclear deal. Now, you gave an interview with the Times of Israel in 2015, I think, in which you said, at least one could interpret that you said, that you didn't think the deal actually prevented Iran from getting the bomb. So are you also agreeing with President Trump that the deal was a bad idea? You've just said that the money did not trickle down to Iranians and that was a disappointment. But was the deal a mistake?
No, I don't think the deal was a mistake. I had questions and some criticisms of the deal because I think it legitimized a very large nuclear infrastructure for the Iranians, and that large nuclear infrastructure means the Iranians have deferred their weapons options, not, in fact, given them up. But the deal itself has put a hold on the Iranian nuclear weapons program, at least for a period of another 13 years. I think it would be a big mistake for us to walk away from the deal because we'd walk away alone. At the very moment where the Iranian public is frustrated and angry, the one thing we shouldn't be doing is shifting the attention away from what the regime is doing to them and putting the focus on us.
Ambassador Dennis Ross, former special assistant to President Obama, thank you so much. We'd love to have you back again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And from NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Agnes Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.